You may be seated.
Morning.
The next case for oral argument this morning is Lynn Althoff versus ProTech Roofing. We have Richard Travis and Tracy Sherrill appearing on behalf of appellant. I understand, Ms. Sherrill, you'll be arguing. And then we have Lee Kit McCarron on behalf of Appalee, Lynn Althoff. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then, Ms. Sherrill, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. With that, you may proceed with your initial argument, Ms. Sherrill.
This is my first time in front of the court, and I do hope there's a lot more opportunities in the future. My name is Tracy Sherrill, and I am with Mae Johnson out of Sioux Falls, and we do represent ProTech Roofing. It is our position that the circuit court erred in three ways. When the circuit court determined that the estate could not prove that the death was a substantial certainty, the circuit court should have issued an order granting the employer summary judgment. Second, the circuit court misapplied South Dakota precedent by replacing substantial certainty with a willful misconduct standard. And third, when the circuit court concluded that a jury could find that the death was a substantial certainty to occur based on a pattern of OSHA violations that were over 4 years old. The facts are actually very brief here. There are no facts in dispute that affect the outcome of this case under this substantive law. On January 7th, 2016, ProTech began a work project on the Watertown Community Center. 3 months later, on April 7th, Mr. Althoff was hired as a roofer. On April 21st of 2016, Mr. Althoff was working on this flat-topped community center roof without a harness, and right prior to his fall, he was warned that he was getting too close to the edge. Tragically, Mr. Althoff did fall off the 33-foot roof within the scope of his employment. There are no disputes that there were OSHA violations by this employer in 2009, 2011, and 2012. There's no evidence of any other falls at this work site or any other work site of ProTech. There's no evidence of any deaths at any of ProTech's work sites. There were no allegations pleaded that ProTech intended the decedent's death, and there's no alleged facts that plausibly demonstrate that of an actual intent. Indeed, there's no scintilla of evidence in the record that ProTech intended for Mr. Althoff to die or that it was substantially certain to occur. Looking through the first error the circuit court made, pursuant to SDCL 6232, workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy for all the on-the-job related injuries unless it can be shown that the employer caused an intentional tort. This court in McMillan set forth three elements in considering and determining whether an intentional tort was committed. That first one is whether the employer had actual knowledge of a dangerous condition. The second was whether or not there was a substantial certainty that injury would occur. And third, whether the employer still required the employee to perform the function or the task. This strict standard requires that the estate allege and to prove an actual intent on the part of the employer or substantial certainty that the injury will occur. When the circuit court found that the estate could not carry its burden to prove that the decedent's death was substantially certain, pursuant to 6232, the analysis should have stopped. It was a duty of the circuit court at that point, as a matter of law, to grant the employer summary judgment. Instead, the circuit court misapplied nearly 30 years of precedent and attempted to replace the substantial certainty standard with a willful misconduct standard. The circuit court stated that the facts evidence an employer that willfully failed to furnish a safe workplace for its employees when the employer neglected or negligently did not follow its own safety rules. If the circuit court had properly considered South Dakota precedent, it should have recognized that the progeny leaves no doubt that permitting a hazardous work condition or willfully failing to furnish a safe place to work or ignoring one's own safety plans still comes within the ambit of work comp. The 1992 case of Brazones stands for this exact proposition. The court then in Harn found that a disengagement of a safety guard, intentional or otherwise, which made the injury probable, still did not rise to the level of a substantial certainty. In the 2000 case of Fryer v. Krantz, this court made it clear that no matter what form the employer's conduct takes, be it careless, grossly negligent, reckless, wanton, if it is not a conscious and deliberate intent directed to the purpose of inflicting injury, workers' compensation remains the exclusive remedy.
Counsel, can you, I understand your argument with regard to the standards that have to be applied. Can you address what types of facts the court can consider when a summary judgment motion is presented to evaluate the circumstances as to whether that substantial certainty standard is present in this case?
What facts they should be looking at all
right.
of the
well,
material.
Well, in this particular case, it seemed to be that you were arguing a very narrow set of facts or circumstances as the only really relevant or material facts that the court should consider in this case. Could you kind of move on, transition now to the facts before the court here and explain why you don't think they met those circumstances here or what the court could or couldn't consider?
Yes, Justice DeBaney. It's my understanding that the circuit court considered all the facts that were before it, including all of the OSHA violations. That was mainly what the circuit court focused on here. The progeny in Harn says that while you can consider the OSHA violations, they are not, they do not cause a substantial certainty. They do not rise to the level of a substantial certainty.
So they could go to the element of did the employer have actual knowledge of the dangerous condition?
Yes, Your Honor, they can. But they have to meet the three elements, though they need to be looking at the three elements. They need to look at the actual knowledge. Was there a substantial certainty? And then the third one, did the employer require the employee still to conduct that task, even though he knew it was a dangerous or hazardous task?
So two of those standards you think were present, but just not the substantial certainty standard?
Actually, Your Honor, it is our position that the two of them were not met. We will concede that the employer likely knew that it was actually dangerous to be up on a 33-foot flat roof working, but there was no substantial certainty, and there is no evidence in the record that the employer directed or made Mr. Althoff perform a function that was so dangerous.
It's interesting. Our cases kind of are grouped into two classes. We've got the safety measure cases. This is one. Harn is one.
Yes, Your Honor.
But in the safety measure cases, it's not as though the lack of a safety measure increases the risk necessarily that there will be an injury. The risk is already there. That's why you have safety measures. We've got that other class of cases, Fryer versus Krantz and others, McMillan, where the employee is directly exposed to something that could present a danger. The test seems to apply immutably and universally to both classes. Would you agree?
Yes, Justice Halter.
Go ahead, please. Sorry.
I was going to ask if you could expand on the point that you made, why you think the third element is not met here again.
So the question of exclusivity is a question, is a matter of law. It is not a question for a jury to decide. It is a question for the court to decide. And so for the circuit court to say that the jury could find that there was a substantial certainty is an error. And you can find that both Harn stands for that, as does Palazzola, a Michigan Court of Appeals case that we cited in our brief. And we cited that because this court has relied on Michigan law in previous cases, i.e. such as Harn. The findings of the current precedent illustrates that the jurisprudence has respected the legislature's policy decision and has narrowly interpreted the intentional tort exception. The circuit court, however, chose to ultimately ignore the precedent, ignore that willful, wanton, or reckless behavior is not the standard in South Dakota, and instead interpreted McMillan and SDCL 6232 to mean that OSHA's role in the workplace must be considered. If you look at the facts of this case, Protect's conduct was no more careless or reckless than any of the other employers cited in the cases. Lastly, when the court found that the jury could find that a substantial certainty was to occur based on a pattern of OSHA violations, that was error because it is a question, as I have explained to you, Justice Salter, for the court to determine whether the facts alleged are sufficient to constitute an intentional tort. It's not for a jury to make that decision. Circuit Court here relied on a case Hill, a district court case from South Dakota, involving a pattern of conduct of an employer condoning sexual assault, perhaps even participating in the sexual assault of multiple employees for over a period of two consecutive years. The court categorized the sexual assault as an intentional tort, thus allowing that case to go to a jury. That is not what we have here, though. No intentional tort has been pleaded, and Protect does not have a pattern of conduct that repeats in a predictable manner, as was in Hill. The last OSHA citation that Protect received was in 2012, 4 years prior to the decedent's death. Moreover, there are no other documented injuries by this particular employer, Protect Roofing. If you look at other courts, they too hold that an employer's violation of federal safety standards or state safety regulations will not constitute an intentional tort for the purposes of eluding workers' comp exclusivity. We cited the cases of Kuhnhart versus John Morrell, the 1993 Eighth Circuit case. Again, we also cited the Palazzola v. Karmazin Production Corporation case from Michigan Court of Appeals from 1997.
You know, it's interesting. We talk about the substantial certainty test with respect to the injury, but I'm not really sure that it's exactly that, because the injury, which, by the way, is the compensable event, that's under 62.117, as you know, this, we don't, you know, it's not compensable for someone to have an incident or a fall or whatever. The injury is the compensable event. And so, on one hand, I can understand the argument. On the other side, in this respect, you know, this is the injury. Is it substantially certain that as Mr. McCarron says in his brief, this is going to happen? This person's going to be either seriously injured or, unfortunately, they'll pass away. There's a substantial certainty as to that injury. But the test from McMillan with the three prongs isolates on a different focus, including the condition, the knowledge of the conditions leading up to the injury. Can you comment on how those, why the test is workable, maybe why our formulation of the test accomplishes what ultimately is this bargain that's been achieved through workers' compensation?
Justice Solter, if I understand your question, and I apologize if I don't in advance.
It's a question, maybe. It's just...
Harn teaches us that you look at the precise event producing the injury. And then when you look at McMillan, you also have to look at... my apologies for losing my spot.
Well, it seems it seems like our test doesn't just leave it at substantial certainty of injury. I guess that was my point. It seems like our test, the one that you quoted from McMillan, seems to broaden the scope of what might seem like a more narrow inquiry, substantial certainty of injury. It's more than that, it seems like.
And, well, your time's up, but you can respond briefly to that.
Or not.
Or not. Thank you, Justice Salter. I will leave it unanswered.
That's fine. Thank you.
Mr. McCarron, you may proceed. You have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May I please support counsel? The facts are undisputed here. In 2019, ProTech was cited for a fall violation. In 2011, ProTech was cited for a fall violation. In 2011, the citation was settled by ProTech agreeing to implement a safety and health program to comply with OSHA standards. Despite that, in 2012, ProTech was issued another OSHA citation, which was a repeat serious fall violation. It's undisputed that ProTech enacted safe work rules, not guidelines, not discretionary, rules. Rule ProTech enacted, number 23 rule, was use safety harness when close to the hazard of falling. The safety program mandated use lifelines, safety harnesses, or lanyards when you are working higher than 6 feet off the ground. Mind you, we're 33 feet off the ground in this case. As counsel indicated, the work started on this project about January 7th of 2016. Every day of that job, ProTech knowingly broke their own rules by failing to provide anyone with safety harnesses, ever.
Mr. McCarron, your opposing counsel points out that despite the fact that admittedly they were not complying strictly with those OSHA requirements or their own safety program, there was no evidence in this record that there had been an injury or a fall, whether you look at that time period between this project starting and when this very tragic fall happened or prior to that. How do you respond to that argument that supports that there's not a substantial certainty that this injury would occur?
If I can answer your question by going to the facts of what occurred on April 21st, and I'm going to combine it with Justice Salter's comments from earlier. On April 21st, the owner of ProTech, Bob Keene, had been on the roof for an hour, and he saw Justin Althoff on the roof, and he knew that he had failed to train Justice Althoff. And he knew that they were breaking the rules, and he knew that Justin wasn't harnessed. And he heard another employee holler at Justin and told him he was about to fall. and Bob Keene turned his back, and the other employee turned his back, and he fell. But, Justice Salter, it's not the fall that's the problem, it's the landing. It's the hit, when he hits the ground. He's going to hit the ground when he's not harnessed. We're not saying that Protec made him fall. They made him hit. They follow their own rules. This Justin Althoff is tied off and can only fall 6 feet. Every day, they intentionally broke the same rule. There isn't anything about every one of these other cases, there's some degree of whoops somewhere along the way at the end. There's no whoops here. This was a daily event when they failed to harness their employees. Every day. This isn't Justice Devaney, this isn't a strict compliance with their safety rules. There isn't any compliance with their safety rules. Their safety rules are a sentence long.
Well, for my, you know, and I'm not certainly, it appeared to me that the OSHA citation itself did refer to there being a warning line, but it wasn't a proper warning line, and that they were kind of loosely having other employees look out for each other, but just didn't have a dedicated safety manner. So there were some attempts, but just not sufficient attempts. Would that be a fair characterization?
Except for that you're missing the point that Justice Salter's raised. It's not the fall that's the problem, it's the land. It's the hit. If he's harnessed, he cannot hit. He can only go 6 feet. I made a motion for summary judgment, and that motion should have been granted that Protec deliberately failed to follow their own safety rules every day.
Well, let me ask it this way, Mr. McCarron. So I understand if you fall off a roof, there's a substantial certainty you're going to get hurt or you're going to die on a 33-foot roof. No question about that. And if you don't have a harness on, that's going to happen. Where I struggle with substantial certainty, because I think you have to look at both parts of it, is was it substantially certain because they violated the rules that he was going to fall off the roof that day? That's.
Was that a question?
That's a question.
Okay, was it substantially certain that he was going to fall off the roof that day? Actually, yes, because Bob Keene saw that he was going to, and the other employee saw that he was going to, and hollered at him that he was going to. But it's not, again, it's not the fall that's the problem, it's the land. Somebody is going to fall off that roof, and if they're unharnessed, they're going, it isn't substantially certain, it's virtually certain.
You say somebody may fall off the roof, that's a probability, that's a possibility, that could happen. But is that a substantial certainty that somebody was going to fall off, and particularly the claimant in this
You're
case?
You're starting to, just.
Smith. Let me finish. There's a substantial certainty that he was going to fall off the roof that day.
Well, I knew that he was going to fall off the roof, but I think that you start the clock too soon, Justice Jensen. I think the clock starts when an employee falls. It doesn't matter if it's Althoff or anyone else. Every one of them's unharnessed. First one got killed. Every one of them's unharnessed. The clock stops when somebody goes over the edge. When somebody falls, it's inevitable somebody is. That's why they have these rules.
Well, when you look at the rules, it appeared to me, and frankly, it was kind of hard to discern it from what's in the record, because I don't know that we had a complete set of at least the company's policy, that there were a number of alternative methods of fall prevention.
And well, you're talking about OSHA, not Protec rules. I'm focusing on Protec rules because what they did is willful misconduct.
Well, I understand, as I said earlier, the distinction that you're making, and I understand your argument. Mr. McCarron, I think one of the difficult things to overcome and to one of the things we have to talk about and confront is that our cases don't make that distinction. And that's what I was doing inartfully, you know, a few minutes earlier. You know, we say substantial certainty of injury, but when you examine the test, it's actually an examination, in fact, not examination of the conditions that lead up to the injury. So I understand your argument. I'm just trying to figure out how that fits within our cases. As they've been developed over the years.
When you said that the injury was the compensable event, you meant the hit, the land.
Well, that was just my comment or my question. So, right, but I'm trying to figure out, but that distinction, and I get that, and I know that's your argument, it's the centerpiece of your argument, and I'm hearing it. But the question is, how do we fold that into our decisional law, which is, you know, there's no real, as I can see, overt effort to roll that back. So assuming we're going to apply the doctrine of stare decisis, we're going to try to fit this in with our existing body of case law. How do we get, given our case law, to where you want to be in this case?
Every day protects foreman's intentional failure to provide safety harnesses was misconduct, as described by statute 642.437. Every day they broke their own rules with what constitutes willful misconduct under statute.
But that statute pertains to a different question than before this court.
Willful misconduct is willful misconduct. By an employee, there isn't a different set of willful misconduct depending on which side of the case you're on. It describes what willful misconduct is.
Which includes reckless conduct under the cases interpreting that statute.
Well,
and we have cases in interpreting the statute at issue that clearly say that that's not enough.
No, this is intentional misconduct. Every day they failed to provide safety harnesses and failed to follow their own rules.
So this
isn't anything reckless. This is intentional. They deliberately, day after day after day, broke their own rules until it killed someone. The OSHA people described it as a free-for-all. I understand that the legislature provided a remedy to prevent free-for-alls, and I understand that there aren't supposed to be a lot of cases that pass the test, but one where they violate their own safety rules every day for 4 months passes that test. If they simply follow their own rules by providing safety harnesses, which they have, they can't make joke about it. If they just follow their own rules by providing safety harnesses, we're not here. Because there's no injury, because there's no hit, like Justice Salter said. It's the injury that's a compensable event, not the free fall. So, again, there is no, every one of those other cases, there was some whoops, or we didn't know, or like, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen when we dropped them in the molasses pit. We didn't know what was going to happen when we put them next to the bowling pins. We didn't know what was going to happen when we took the guard off the saw. We know what's going to happen when you don't provide your safety harnesses. You're going to hit the ground. That's their own rules. I'm not complaining that they didn't follow OSHA. I'm not complaining what they did was a bad idea. I'm not complaining that what they did was reckless.
See, this is that classic cases. So there's a classic cases that are these direct exposure cases, and there's these safety measure cases. Harn is one, and this is one. How does this case differ from Harn? You know, there's, you know, you jam a piece of wood so that the anti-kickback safety device doesn't work, and is the employer any less aware that that's going to cause serious injury than the employer might have been here?
Yes, there's some sort of I wonder what happens here thing. Well, their own rules, they violate their own rules every day. I think Justice Salter, if you focus on, there's a lot of cases where you interpreted willful misconduct on claimants who drank before driving, or maybe pills, or any number of things that were just dumb ideas.
Well, that may be willfulness may be a different standard, but in any event, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, it's an employee willful misconduct that's the statute describes, right? 62.437 describes the willful misconduct of an employee, and it's the ProTech owner, the ProTech employee, who is deliberately violating his own rules every day, who he only enacted to get out of prior problems with OSHA. So he mandated use, the ProTech owner mandated the use of safety harnesses and deliberately failed to provide them every day. That's the intentional conduct. It's not myopically limited to April 21st. It's every day of that job he did the same thing. Molasses was a one-day deal. You certainly wouldn't let him drop that guy in the molasses vat for 4 months. This, they committed their own internal violation every day of their own rules and laws for 4 months. Then they saw this kid near the edge. They saw that he was going to fall. They knew that he was unharnessed. And both of them turned their back on him. That's no different than just pushing him off the edge at the same time. They knew he was going to go. How can it get any worse than that? Than every day breaking your own rules and seeing that this kid's, and knowing that you didn't train him that like your own like is required, and knowing that he's at the edge, what occurred was exactly what they saw was going to occur when they turned their back on him. And they knew that he was unharnessed. And Justice Alter, what happens then is when he goes, where any employee goes, he's going to hit the ground, and it's the injury that's the compensable event, not so much the fall. That's what I'm saying. The clock starts on the interpretation of this either on January 7th or when he's in free fall. Because when he's at, when Justice Althoff, when he goes over the edge, he can only go 6 feet if ProTech follows their own rules. But they deliberately broke their own rules every day for 4 months. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCarron. Cheryl, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Justice Salter, to try and answer your question that you left me with is how narrow is substantial certainty? It is very narrow in that that's what the legislature intended for the intentional tort exception to be in workers' comp. What's being tested is the narrow issue of an intentional versus accidental quality of that precise event producing the injury.
Counsel, I'd like you to respond as part of that to Mr. McCarron's explanation of what made it substantially certain that Mr. Althoff would experience a fall on that day.
Yes, Justice Kern, I will attempt to answer that. I do not believe that there was anything that was substantially certain that Mr. Althoff was going to fall on that day at all. I believe that given that Mr. Althoff and all of the other workers had been on that roof for anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 months, it was not about when an accident would happen. As Chief Justice pointed out, a certainty, it was a matter of a question of would it happen, a probability. And that is really what we're dealing with here. I mean, not following your own rules, you have to consider probabilities, but it does not make it a substantial certainty that any accident was going to occur. Moreover, there were harnesses available to the employees on the roof that day.
Can you respond to Mr. McCarron's comment that factually, and I know there was a fact in the record about somebody warning him, what was the proximity of that warning? And you mentioned turning the backs on him. And can you respond to that factually?
Yes, Justice, Chief Justice, I can. Mr. Althoff was not warned that he was going to fall. Mr. Althoff was warned he was getting too close to the edge. One of his coworkers.
Is that a distinction without a difference, though? I mean, do we know the proximity of where he was at that point? Has that been developed in the record?
It has not been developed, Chief Justice, at all that I am aware of. I do understand, it is my understanding, that Mr. Althoff was on the inside of the warning line that was in place. I do not believe that he was on the outside of the warning line, and that warning line gave at least a couple of feet distance before the edge of that roof. That is my understanding from the record.
So there's a warning and saying, hey, you're getting close to the warning line, or you're on the warning line, or something like that.
Yes, Chief Justice.
Is there further response? Is there what happens at that point? Do we know factually?
My understanding from the facts and from the record that may not be fully developed here, but from our record, is that he acknowledged that he was getting too close. The coworker that warned him went to go grab, my understanding is, a few more pieces of insulation. So he turned his back briefly to pick up something. And when he turned around, that is when Mr. Althoff had fallen over the edge.
When, counsel, I know you advocated that the substantial certainty is a question of law for the court to make. and cited the Michigan case, which I don't think any of our cases specifically state that. Is there a role for a jury determination in these types of cases where you would get to a point where there's sufficient facts in the record from which reasonable inferences could be drawn under summary judgment standards to meet the substantial certainty level that it would then go to a jury to make that factual determination?
Justice Devaney, I believe the Hill case is a good example of a question that would go to a jury because there a actual intentional tort was alleged. There is no intentional tort alleged in this case. There is not even any evidence that says that there was any substantial certainty that this fall would occur.
So is it your position that only in actual intentional tort cases the question can go to a jury, but not in these substantial certainty scenarios or questions?
Justice Devaney, it is my understanding, and I apologize if I'm not answering your question correctly, you have to achieve the substantial certainty test in order to show an intentional tort. Once you've been able to do that, then yes, you can send it to a jury for a decision. And we do have case law in South Dakota. Harn actually answered the question when there's no disputes as to the material facts. The question is a matter of law, and that matter of law is whether or not there was an intentional tort. And in this instance, there is not an intentional tort. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments in this case. The case is now submitted to the court. We'll be in recess until 11 o'clock.